Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. He writes a weekly column for Truth.
Intelligence agencies is known for Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, Barrett Brown. There is no free press.
Quickly, for people, most of our viewers must know this, but quickly, just what is it that Jeremy exposed?
He broke into the private security firm known as Stratfor, which does work for a variety of intelligence agencies, the Marine Corps and the Defense Department, the Pentagon, but also for corporations, including Raytheon, Dow Chemical, and others. And he turned over 3 million emails, email exchanges within the company, to Rolling Stone, WikiLeaks, and other publications. Now, this was quite a significant dump because it illustrated two or three very chilling things about the security and surveillance state. First of all, that there was no division between corporate spying and government spying. It was seamless, including the same people going back and forth. It was from that dump that we realized the extent to which the Occupy movement was being spied upon and infiltrated and monitored and followed.
Those with lots of dollars have lots of power. Those with no dollars have no power. So elections are the one time people have an opportunity to come in and select who's going to control the government, really weigh in on what the policies will actually be. It's the one moment of real leverage citizens have. And we think what's happened in the last generation, and especially in the last decade, is the power of citizens to act as an effective force has been reduced to the point of near elimination.
According to a report released Monday by the Pew Research Center, Americans currently lead the world in compressing big sandwiches into sufficiently biteable sizes.
Knows that money and media are destroying our elections, as you say. Why another autopsy?
Well, this isn't an autopsy. This is the product of 3 years of work. Bob and I are political junkies. I mean, there's no other way to say it. We love politics. We love covering it. We love talking about it. And we feel a sense of loss. We feel a sense of loss in America where our elections are no longer these great battles of ideas, but in fact, very controlled events, managed events. And so after the Citizens United movement of 2010, which essentially freed up corporate money to flow into politics, we knew that this is a big enough pivot point that we should step back and spend the next few years looking at how an American presidential election and all the elections beneath it play out. And so we looked at the 2012 cycle from start to finish over a 3-4 year period. And what we determined was that we didn't know much at all about how bad it was. And so instead of the $6 billion that all the news headlines said was spent on the 2012 election cycle, it was actually more than $10 billion, because most of the groups that analyze it don't look at state, local, and referendum elections. And we also brought, I think, something very different to this. We're saying that as you have this inflow of money, this huge amount of money flowing in, we also have to stand down of journalism. We have lost tens of thousands of journalists, newsrooms closing down, newspapers cutting back. The World Wide Web has not filled the void by any means. And so we have a situation where massive inflow of money and the check and balance of journalism declining, you end up with almost a perfect situation for propagandizing the American people, for managing their debates into a narrow zone.
And we also found from those email exchanges that there was a concerted attempt on the part of security officials, both inside the government and within the private security contracting agency, to link false, nonviolent dissident groups with terrorist groups.
Yikes.
So that they could apply terrorism laws against these groups. And when I sued Barack Obama over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which permits the U.S. military, overturning 150 years of domestic law, to seize U.S. citizens who substantially support — that is not a legal term, it's not material support, it's an amorphous term — substantially support Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or something called associated forces, again another nebulous term, hold those citizens in military facilities without due process indefinitely.
Hey, this is the Furious George Show. Gotta say thanks to Bill out there who helped make this segment happen. I am spinning into some new stuff, and we're gonna take on the next hour or so, as we do every week here at the Furious George Show on WCOMLP Chapel Hill Carborough, Borough, low power FM micropower radio. I'm furious tonight, talking about some more of this dissent. It's out there, so many forms. Repressed, etc., etc. You're not furious, you're not paying attention. I'm in here with DJ Eddie Abbey, and we are spinning some craziness. We're going to get back into it. Chris Hedges, also about Moyers on Big Money, other reports. So stick around, and I just have to make it a little funky too. Right there in the low, the background is the low end theory, the low ground, and we're going to trademark that right now. We also want to spin in some new craziness. So we have the new Low End Theory Mix 24. We'll be cranking into some more. And also, like, brand new stuff, like, right off the internets. So we'll see how it goes. This is Schoolboy Q coming up here at Collard Greens. Explicit. Oh, yeah, this show may be offensive to some of you all out there. Stick around. If you want to learn more about Furious George, go to furiousg.blogspot.com. Or, hey, look, check out WCOMFM.org. Good, good. I'm furious! See ya.
Down with the shit, yeah. Lift that,
59% of rape cases, 36.2% of violent states, are never solved. In 2011, less than half of all violent crimes found any resolution. It sort of makes you wonder, why are so many violent criminals walking free? I'm Alex Kreit, professor of criminal law. To start, let's take a look at New York City. Since Michael Bloomberg has been mayor, police have spent 1 million man-hours working 440,000 arrests for, get this, marijuana possession. That's a lot of police busting parties instead of tracking down violent criminals. This goes beyond any one city or state. Nationwide, we would save $41.3 billion every year by ending the war on drugs.
Function on fire, burn the roof off this month of sight. Wood is calling, go crazy like no other weed, steady blowing. Pass the boy to my mama, runs in the family. But puff, keep a nigga fiend. Faded, 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 ride, shot glass, super.
For a year now, they voted in a new measure that levies a 15% excise tax and a 10% sales tax on the product. With these cities amending their marijuana laws following the lead of Colorado and Washington State, one has to wonder which U.S. cities and states will follow. And what does this mean for the future of the so-called war on drugs? Joining us now to discuss the recent marijuana legalization and taxation votes and the ramifications of all of this is Morgan Fox. He's the communications manager at the Marijuana Policy Project, which is an advocacy group that works towards national legalization of marijuana. And joining us in studio is Neil Franklin. He is the executive director of Full Penalty, punishable by only a civil fine. What makes the election results in Portland so significant?
Well, I think that they're indicative of a national trend in thinking that it is starting to say that marijuana prohibition is an utter failure. People are finally starting to realize this. And as of just last month, 58% of the American public feel that marijuana should be taxed and regulated similarly to alcohol. These measures are just an indication that that is really a truism across the country.
Okay, let's get to you, Neil. Let's talk a little bit about the ACLU report that recently came out. It found that in 2010, there was one marijuana arrest every 37 seconds, and states spent a combined over $3.6 billion enforcing marijuana possession laws. Will there be any savings to taxpayers in the cities where they have voted to legalize marijuana from cutting back policing and prison costs and things like that?
It depends on how that city manages this new policy. But it's definitely going to be a savings for law enforcement. They'll be able to redirect their limited sources to crimes of violence, which is a benefit for the citizens, obviously. So they'll be able to focus on murder, rape, robbery, domestic violence. And I'll tell you, from my experience, just about every city can use more attention in those areas. Over the past few decades, we've actually been solving less violent crime across the country than what we have in the past, and you'd think that would be better with, you know, you think we would do better with more technology today, but this will free up a ton of resources for law enforcement to refocus their priorities here.
And Morgan, I wanted to ask you about estimates of how much new revenue actually this will bring to the state of Colorado.
Well, that has yet to be determined. It really depends on exactly what the market begins to bear and whether or not these businesses are able to effectively implement their business plans, as well as to stick with the laws that are set forth by Colorado and the criterion that has been laid out by the Department of Justice. But it looks to be in the tens of millions of dollars throughout the state. You know, estimates at this industry nationwide are at something around $30 billion, but that varies from estimate to estimate. But this is a huge industry, and right now we're letting it be controlled by violent criminals instead of legitimate businesses.
Thank you.
seeking enough help, there's definitely policies that's in place now to start to address these veterans who are coming back and having some issues that relate to their military experience, specifically that combat experience. But I could speak for myself and how I've, you know, handled my own transition from the military. And
please.
Well, it was difficult when I first got out in 2005. I started working with the VA. I was one of the fortunate ones that started working with the VA while I was still in the Army. So the transition from my health care was rather seamless. But it was a difficult road that lasted for about 3.5 years, and I'm still having my issues that I work with on a day-to-day basis, but the difference is I have a lot more tools in my bag now to start to work through those issues.
What are those issues?
Some of those, I mean, on a bad day, it could be problems with, you know, anger, frustration, anxiety. I still have some issues going into crowded shopping centers, and it's been since 2005 since I've been back from Iraq.
What was the
each day brings its own challenges.
What was your original response in terms of seeking help? Where did you go?
So when I first came back from Iraq, I was in Germany, stationed in Stuttgart, and I started noticing that I was having a lot of anxiety and struggling to maintain. So I went and I saw them, and they agreed to keep it confidential, and they gave me Valium, which helped at first. You know, it got me to sleep. It pretty much knocked me out. I then requested official health therapy, essentially. And from that inpatient session, then I was introduced to my psychologist, my counselors, my psychiatrist who prescribed the medications and whatnot. I started going through groups, one-on-one sessions with my VA counselor, going through various treatment programs that were having all these adverse effects. Look into cannabis and the possible beneficial effects that it might have for me. I talked with a few friends that were using it. They told me what their systems were, what they found worked for them, and I started to catalog my use of it, how often I was using it, how much I was smoking, how long the effect lasted. But it was still very much something that I kept to myself because of the stigma around it.
Part of the email exchanges were entered as evidence in my case, and those email exchanges showed that this private security firm, along with government officials, was attempting to link a group called US Day of Rage, founded by a journalist and activist named Alex O'Brien, who was one of my co-plaintiffs, with Al-Qaeda.
That's tens of millions of man hours in investigation, office work, and court appearances for drug cases. We're choosing to direct these law enforcement resources to crimes other than rapes and murders, only to end up arresting and incarcerating large numbers of nonviolent offenders. Worse yet, the war on drugs doesn't even work. In the United States, 7 million people are under correctional supervision, many for drug-related charges. 81% of all drug arrests are for simple possession. That's millions of people in the system who never restrained, assaulted, killed, or abused another person. And despite the money and time spent, it's never been easier to buy drugs. Compare that to Portugal, which decriminalized the personal use of all drugs 12 years ago. Since then, there's evidence that their criminal justice system has become leaner and more efficient. They chose to treat addiction as an illness, not a crime, and to make a meaningful distinction between violent and nonviolent offenders. This has also, unsurprisingly, helped those most vulnerable to the harms of controlled substances by decreasing their use among children and lowering the number of new HIV infections. Who in our society is in pain, and how can we help them? We can direct more resources to prosecute violent offenders, actual criminals who leave behind victims and survivors. We can ensure every single victim of assault or sexual violence a full and credible investigation of their claims. Even if we disagree on the legal status of drugs, can't we make that guarantee to victims first? We should ask ourselves, who are the real victims of the government's war on drugs?
Force has been reduced to the point of near elimination.
So why rub our nose in it? I mean, everybody, as I said in the opening, knows that money and media are destroying our elections, as you say. Why another autopsy?
Well, this isn't an autopsy. This is the product of 3 years of work. Bob and I are political junkies. I mean, there's no other way to say it. We live in America, voted.
Is to raise money. That the traditional standards of commercial journalism was that editors and reporters did their job well, and they would automatically get an audience, and then the advertised people could sell the ads, and they didn't really have to have too much contact. And there was sort of a separation of church and state, as the saying went, in news media. That's disappeared. Now the reporters and the editors have to be every bit as cognizant of the commercial value of what they produce as the advertising salespeople had to be.
You must have seen the story that Time Inc. has abolished the position of editor-in-chief, and the editors of all of Time's magazines will now report to the business side through a new senior content officer. What does that tell you?
Well, what it tells us is Time's catching up with just about everybody else, and this is the painful reality. You know, when broadcast media came into being, and it was initially thought of as a service. Right? You didn't expect to make a profit off the news. Well, give credit to the folks at 60 Minutes. They showed you can make money doing news. And so now in broadcast media, for a long time, news shows have been profit centers. They're supposed to make money. They're supposed to have a return.
And why were they trying to link that group with Al-Qaeda? So that they could employ the draconian terrorism laws against nonviolent democratic dissidents.
Production. That was just the PJD's. We'll be right back.
drink. I don't do drugs anymore. I used to take drugs and I quit. But I'll tell you something. I have nothing against drugs whatsoever. That's kind of weird, huh? You never heard that one. Used to take drugs, quit, and have nothing against them. Wow, never heard that. Let's hear more. Okay. I'll tell you something else. I know this is not a very popular idea. You don't hear it very often anymore. But it's the truth. I have taken drugs before, and I had a real good time. Sorry.
Taken the first steps toward changing that, and I think that these cities that just passed laws, while not regulating the marijuana industry or controlling supply, have indicated that they are headed in that direction. So we're going to start seeing more and more cities and states start to take control of their marijuana markets, as opposed to enforcing these laws against nonviolent marijuana users and enriching criminal gangs.
We can't talk about legalizing marijuana without getting the other side of this issue. We actually had a former drug policy advisor to three U.S. administrations, Kevin Sabat, on The Real News, and we got into a debate about the topic. He opposed legalization and said that those with small possessions, small amounts of marijuana, are not actually being targeted. Let's take a look.
That all came out from him.
And you can see an example of a related thing, the way the British are calling Glenn Greenwald's partner, David Miranda, calling him a terrorist.
Right. Well, we have, you know, our most courageous investigative journalists are in self-imposed exile, including Jacob Applebaum, including Glenn Greenwald, including Sarah Harrison, she's British, who is now in exile in Berlin because she accompanied Snowden, if you remember, to Russia. She came back into her own country. It is really terrifying. And when you couple that with the fact that the security and surveillance state has effectively shut down investigation into national security, the national security apparatus by the traditional press, largely through the Espionage Act, but also because we now know that, and more importantly, those who might be whistleblowers know that all of electronic communications are captured and stored in perpetuity by the state, meaning that anyone who decides to reach out to a journalist can be very easily traced.
According to a report released Monday by the Pew Research Center, Americans currently lead the world in compressing big sandwiches into sufficiently biteable sizes, outranking countries such as Germany, Slovenia, and Ukraine in their sheer capacity to squeeze BLTs, meatball subs, and grinders into shapes that will easily and efficiently fit into their open mouths.
We now know that Americans are far and away global leaders in their ability to pick up a triple-decker club or steak hoagie and squish it together so it maintains its structure. Integrity while they eat it.
Researchers pointed out that in series after series of tests, Americans consistently topped international rankings by implementing over 800 pounds per square inch of compressive force on sandwich categories as diverse as banh mi, croque monsieur, or gyros, rarely hesitating for more than a moment before diving in and pushing the bread together and wedging it into their mouth.
Even in the cases in which Americans fail to sufficiently compress a sandwich and, say, dropped a stray piece of bacon or avocado, which, let me emphasize, was extremely rare, they still led the pack on quickly scooping up this topping with their hands and eating it, sometimes even inventively doing so with a stray potato chip or french fry. Really, any way you look at it, the ingenuity with which Americans approach their sandwich eating is an incredible sight to behold.
For more on this story, check this week's...
High as a motherfucker. Fuck a bitch, yep, I'm a motherfucker. Watch me on the front. I'ma go ape like a motherfucker. Mix it, twist it, lick it, lick it now. I be breathing while my nigga deviating on the wagon. Parasit and that's around us. If he's sipping, surrounded for fucking fittings. Trying to make it killing. Chasing up that million. No kidding. I'm shitting. Just chilling. Black eyes, cold heart, soul don't exist no more.
Didn't murder anybody, didn't rob anybody, didn't rape anybody, didn't beat anybody, didn't lose one fucking job, laughed my ass off, and went about my day. Sorry. Now, where's my commercial? I'll be the guy holding that skillet in that commercial, man. That ain't a brain, that's breakfast.
When you forge a weapon,
let's
you need three things. The right metal, temperatures over 1400 degrees.
What have we been up, 5 days now? I'm fucking starving!
We got all three.
I find that commercial a tad insulting to my intelligence. I've seen a lot of things on drugs, but I have never, ever, ever looked at an egg and thought it was a fucking brain. Not once. I have seen UFOs split the sky like a sheet, but I have never looked at an egg and thought it was a fucking brain. Not once. I have had 7 balls of light come off of a UFO, lead me onto their ship, explain to me telepathically that we are all one and there's no such thing as death. But I've never looked at an egg and thought it was a fucking brain. Now, maybe I wasn't getting good shit, but that's what I hate about the war on drugs. I'll be honest with you, it's what I can't stand. It's all day long we see those commercials. Here's your brain on drugs. Just say no. Why do you think they call it dope? And then the next commercial is
this bud's for you.
Come on, everybody, let's be hypocritical bastards. Other drugs.
City has one of the highest rates of racial disparity in marijuana arrests of anywhere in the country, that is disenfranchising an entire section of the population during a time of great economic growth. But I think that we're going to see a lot of cities following Portland and Ferndale and these other cities in Michigan over the next year. But we're certainly going to see several ballot initiatives at the state level, definitely in Alaska, where MPP will be working with local advocates, and in California and Oregon as well. And then in 2016, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that we're going to see 5 or 6 more states make marijuana legal within their states, at which point Congress will definitely have to address the issue simply because of the number of states that are out of line with federal law.
Neil, do you really think we'll get Congress to address the issue anytime soon?
I think so. I think they have to. I don't think they're going to have a choice in this matter. I compare this to the end of alcohol prohibition in 1933. It wasn't the federal government that moved to end prohibition. It was the states, the individual states. And right here in this wonderful state of Maryland in which I live, they never supported alcohol prohibition. So it's the states that are moving the new marijuana policy, ending prohibition for marijuana. It's going to move across the country, and then the federal government's going to have to respond. And that's the plan. That's the key. Let's not give them a choice. Let's not give them an option. Let's force them to do it.
incidentally, tax drugs. Ooh, how does this fucking work? Thank God they're taxing alcohol, man. It means we got those good roads we can get fucked up and drive on. Thank God they're taxing this shit, man. We'd be doing donuts in a wheat field right now. Thank God we're on a highway. To legalize a drug, it sure wouldn't have been alcohol. Sorry, there's better drugs and better drugs for you. That's a fact. You may stop your internal dialogue. But Bill, alcohol is an acceptable part. Shut the fuck up. You're wrong. Okay? Okay.
Sort of makes you wonder, why are so many violent criminals walking free?
Not a journalist, but as a former investigative journalist for the New York Times, a truly terrifying development.
So Jeremy's going to be sentenced on Friday. Talk a little bit about him and what motivated Jeremy Hammond, as you know. You spent some time with him in prison.
Yeah, I was at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York where he's being held on Wednesday with him for the afternoon. He's not allowed to have social visits because of a series of minor infractions, including his tier, getting a hold of some marijuana. But he can see journalists, although it took me 2 months to get in to see him. I found him, you know, he's a follower of the Black Bloc, and I'm very critical of the Black Bloc. But nevertheless, I certainly recognize the right of the Black Bloc to exist. And not only that, I don't think anyone should be criminalized for what they believe, including if they are supportive of the Black Bloc. So he comes out of the Black Bloc, but he's one of those rare examples of somebody who has these amazing technical skills and sort of being able to hack, but also a deep political consciousness. And a lot of times that doesn't always go with hackers. As a high school student, during the Bush call to invade Iraq, led a walkout of students from his high school. He founded an underground newspaper. He was involved in all sorts of acts of civil disobedience. I think he'd been arrested by the time he was 21 10 times, including protesting against the Republican National Convention when it was held in New York. And he had hacked into a right-wing group, I think it was called Patriot Warrior, and for that he'd gone to prison in Illinois for 2 years. When he got out, he was, I guess this is in a few states, and Illinois is one of them, they can put you under a curfew in your own house, so from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. you have to be in your house. So he was living under curfew, and from all we can see, and really sort of avoiding the kind of hacking activity that had gotten him to so much trouble, he was working with Food Not Bombs and these kinds of groups, and delivering books to prisoners. I mean, he has a real social consciousness. Very influenced, by the way, by the old anarchists. He said he made frequent trips to the monument in the Chicago cemetery for the martyrs of the Haymarket labor uprising, four of whom were hanged. Emma Goldman's buried very close by. Reads a lot, thinks a lot. And it was 2010, and Chelsea, then Bradley Manning, was arrested for giving those documents and videos to WikiLeaks. And he said that really prompted him, that he knew he had the skills to do something like that. And that the act, the courageous act that Manning did and the sacrifice that Manning made prompted him to act, although he knew now, because he couldn't move around, he couldn't leave his house, he was still living under curfew, that his chances of being caught were high. And yet he went ahead and hacked into this security firm. He didn't seek any financial gain, and he didn't get any. I mean, this for me as a journalist is the work of a classic whistleblower who wants to make public information that we have a right to know. It's our information.
So the argument you would get from President Obama or his supporters, and this is all being done under the Obama administration, who's been especially vigorous at going after whistleblowers.
Far worse than Bush.
Their argument's going to be a state has a right to protect its secrets, particularly its security secrets. A corporation has a right to protect its secrets. I mean, how do you deal with this issue? How do you balance this?
Not when they shred the Constitution and violate our most basic right to privacy. Not only that, remember that we now know from this information that they are actively working to criminalize democratic dissent. That's a crime. It should be a crime. And whatever crime Jeremy Hammond committed is nothing, pales in comparison to the crimes that are being committed by the state.
You never see positive drug stories on the news, do you? Isn't that weird? Since most of the experiences I've had on drugs were real fucking positive. Who are these morons they're finding? That's what I want to know. I used to want to call the news. Come over to our house. Watch Tommy. He's a pig. Film him. He's been doing that for hours. He's killing us. always that same LSD story. You've all seen it. Young man on acid, thought he could fly, jumped out of a building. What a tragedy. What a dick. Fuck him. He's an idiot. If he thought he could fly, why didn't he take off on the ground first? Check it out. You don't see ducks lined up to catch elevators to fly south. They fly from the ground, you moron. Quit ruining for everybody. He's a moron. He's dead. Good. We lost a moron. Fucking celebrate. Wow, I just felt the world get lighter. We lost a moron. Put on the Hammer album. I'm ready to dance. We lost a moron. I don't mean to sound cold or cruel or vicious, but I am, so that's the way it comes out. Professional help is being sought. How about a positive LSD story? Wouldn't that be newsworthy just once? To base your decision on information rather than scare tactics and superstitions and lies? I think it would be newsworthy. Today, a young man on acid realized that all matter is merely energy condensed to a slow vibration. That we are all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. There's no such thing as death. Life is only a dream, and we're the imagination of ourselves. Here's Tom with the weather. It's fantastic, and I hope you enjoyed it. There is a point. Is there a point to all this? Let's find a point. There are points in my act. I would say there is. I have to. The world is like a ride at an amusement park. And when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud. And it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride. And we kill those people. Shut him up. We have a lot invested in this ride. Shut him up. Look at my furrows of worry. Look at my big bank account. And my family. This has to be real. Ride. But we always kill those good guys who try and tell us that. You ever notice that? And let the demons run amok? But it doesn't matter, because it's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space.
This country was founded on that notion. We actually were the pioneers of understanding the importance of investing in a free press. The first century of American history is all about massive public subsidies through the post office and printing subsidies to create the most diverse, dissenting news media ever known in the universe.
Whatever crime Chelsea Manning may have committed, it is nothing compared to the war crimes and the fraud and the lies that are being perpetrated by the corporate state. And I think that's the point, that when you shut down the possibility of a free press, when there is no judicial or legislative oversight, and there isn't anymore, the abuse of power becomes rife, especially when you build walls of secrecy. And the last best hope are these people who can break down those walls and make public that information which we have a right to know. We have a right to know that the government is criminalizing our forms of protest and attempting to treat us as if we were terrorists.
My country is being tested by this hailstorm called Super Typhoon Haiyan. We remain uncertain as to the full extent of the damage and devastation as information trickles in agonizingly slow manner because power lines and communication lines have been cut off and may take a while before they are restored. The initial assessment showed that Haiyan left a wake of massive destruction that is unprecedented, unthinkable, and horrific. And the devastation is staggering. I struggle to find words even for the images that we see on the news coverage, and I struggle to find words to describe how I feel about the losses. Up to this hour, I agonize, waiting for word to the fate of my very own relatives. What gives me renewed strength and great relief is that my own brother has communicated to us and he had survived the onslaught. I speak for my delegation, but I speak for the countless people who will no longer be able to speak for themselves after perishing from the storm. I speak also for those who have been orphaned by the storm. I speak for those of the people now racing against time to save survivors and alleviate the suffering of the people affected. We can take drastic action now to ensure that we prevent a future where super typhoons become a way of life. Can we ever attain the ultimate objective of the convention, which is to prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system? By failing to meet the objective of the convention, we may have ratified our own doom. We have to confront the issue of loss and damage. Loss and damage is a reality today across the world. We cannot solve climate change when we seek to spew more emissions. In solidarity with my countrymen who are struggling to find food back home, and with my brother who has not had food for the last 3 days, with all due respect, Mr. President, and I mean no disrespect for your kind hospitality, I will now commence a voluntary fasting for the climate. This means I will voluntarily refrain from eating food during this COP until a meaningful outcome is in sight. Until concrete pledges have been made to ensure mobilization of resources for the Green Climate Fund, we cannot afford a fourth COP with an empty GCF. Until the promise of the operationalization of a loss and damage mechanism has been fulfilled, until there is assurance on finance for adaptation, until we see real ambition on climate action in accordance with the principles we have so upheld. Mr. President, this process has been called a farce. It has been called an annual carbon-intensive gathering of useless frequent flyers. It has also been called saving tomorrow today. We can fix this. We can stop this madness.
Thank you, Philippines, for your great speech. Thank you.
climate change conference is currently underway in Warsaw, Poland. Critics say it has among the highest corporate presence of any UN climate change summit to date. And with the government-sponsored World Coal Summit being held next door, some have dubbed this year's climate negotiations the Coal Cop. Now joining us to discuss this, the corporate influence at the COP19, is Rachel Tanzi. She's a
industry and business lobbying around the climate talks. But what's unique about this year is that the presidency of the UNFCCC, that's the UN's climate negotiating body, which is currently the Polish government, has invited 12 and now actually 13 different companies to be partners to the conference. And these partners are corporations which are profiting from contributing to climate change. We have oil and gas companies like the French conglomerate Alstom, two Polish coal and oil companies, PGE and Lotos. There's the big world's biggest steel company, ArcelorMittal, not to mention BMW and General Motors, Emirates Airlines. Basically all corporations which are contributing massively to climate change, if you look at the effects of their businesses, but even more importantly, they're lobbying very, very hard and doing their best to prevent effective climate action, to prevent the kind of progress we need to see in the climate talks. And yet they've been embraced into this, into these climate talks.
What's the new model for paying for journalism? As if, there's going to be some sort of magical calculus that comes up. And over time, we came to the conclusion that the answer is actually very simple. We found the model. We got it. It's established. It's working. It's very, very functional. Germany, Norway, Britain, all the countries with which we might compare ourselves, all have massively funded public and community media.
Rarely hesitating for more than a moment before diving in and pushing the bread together and wedging it into their mouths.
Even in the cases in which Americans fail to sufficiently compress a sandwich and, say, dropped a stray piece of bacon or avocado, which, let me emphasize, was extremely rare, they still led the pack on quickly scooping up this topping with their hands and eating it, sometimes even inventively doing so with a stray potato chip or french fry. Really?
Okay, hey, this is the Furious George Show, doing some special late night hours. We're taking into the night different themes, one kind or another, from climate change to problems with the media, to issues relating to the marijuana prohibition, to other issues. So if you somehow see a thread that ties them all together, you might be interested in furiousg.blogspot.com, where we've been doing that for the last, 15 years or so. You can also check out Furious G through WCOMFM.org, where you can learn more about this awesome station we have here. Or you can call us right now if you want to, 919-999-9601. Or, who knows, email the Furious George Show at Gmail. There's so many different ways. Check it out. That there in the background, some crazy instrumental Jay-Z. Boom, boom, boom. We'll see. Apparently this particular track has the better break, where they get even crazier in the beats, which is what we do here continuously. Get crazy with the beats. Myself and DJ little Eddie Abbey there is ready to roll. So we're gonna be playing a couple more tunes, something made out of some old school Laser Sword and some other fun stuff. Thanks for listening. This is Micropower Community Based Radio. I'm Furious.